nevertheless challenging, it turns out, the simple problem of trying to look at causal inference for binary outcomes using an instrumental variable. And part of the renewed interest is that it's used a lot in Mendelian randomization field. It's quite popular these days, and, thank you, yes. My co-author's names to be pronounced. My own name is Goedgebeur, it's bad enough. And then Stijn van Steeland, who did a lot of the work on this, together with a joint PhD student who is. Who is Iranian, just graduated Manucher Babanezat, but whether that's the correct pronunciation, I wouldn't back on it. All right, thank you. All right, so a little while ago, Stijn and I had proposed a method for generalized linear structural mean models, and one application was logistic structural mean models for binary outcome data with instrumental variables. Jamie found that it had some problems and proposed an alternative. And today we find that in Mendelian randomization field, amongst others, neither of these two methods are being used, but a whole range of approximate estimators are being used instead. So it prompted us to have a renewed look at our own approach, at Jamie's, and these approximate ways of doing things, and then to try and find, can we perhaps suggest one that might work best in some circumstances and some in others. And partly also what prompted me to look at this is that about a year ago, I listened to a talk at Harvard from Brookhart, who analyzed data on COX-2 inhibitors and GI complications from it. And because his outcome was binary, he decided he wanted to use structural models with the instrumental variables. He decided he needed to resort to linear structural mean models, even though the outcome was binary. And it seemed such a shame because there's quite a lot around for binary outcomes. So that's the purpose and the gist of the talk. So the problem that Brookhart presented was COX-2 inhibitors, which are anti-inflammatory drugs, one of a class, are the new elements of that class and have been found in randomized clinical trials to actually reduce a severe risk of GI complications. And they were hoping to find that finding back as implemented in the field, so in broader populations, looking at observational studies, and there they couldn't find a GI protective effect of the COX-IPs when prescribed. But of course, it has all the complications associated with observational studies. It's given the reputation, it's quite likely that the COX-IPs are selectively prescribed to patients at higher risk of bleeding. And on the other hand, in these large observational databases, the covariates were typically poorly measured, and they sort of wanted to avoid them. So they had looked very, very hard on a lot of work to try and find an instrument that they could use for this analysis. They've published several papers just on arguing and motivating that an instrument might be the physician preference, which I'll call Z here. So an instrument for inferring the effect of the choice of NSAID X, COX-2 inhibitor or not, on the risk of GI bleeding, which is my outcome. So we will be assuming that we have an instrumental variable, and in particular that the physician's preference of what NSA to prescribe is correlated with what they actually prescribe on the one hand, and is on the other hand, and that's harder to justify, does not come with a different patient population or risk mix. So in that sense, the natural risk of GI bleeding is not associated with the physician's general preference of which of these COX-IPs to prescribe. So they've done a lot of work on trying to argue that that was indeed a justifiable instrument in this case. I will not go into that too much here. I will assume that that is the case, so that we have this instrument which is valid and that we can work with it to try from the observational data to infer that effect. And so the database that they studied was a large one, population-based cohort, 37,000 new NSAID users. They identified the prescribing physician, looked at whether for any particular patient they were placed on a Coxib or not, whether they had a GI bleeding within 60 days or not, and then to specify the instrument in this setting, they were actually very much aware that there was an era of aggressive marketing for these new two COX-2 inhibitors, and that they kind of needed a dynamic measure of the physician preference, and ultimately they came up with a binary one which was expressing what the most recent prescription had been of this physician, new prescription. So if for the previous patient that he had a new prescription for or she, it was a COX-2 inhibitor, then the instrument was set to 1, and otherwise it was set to 0. So it changed over time for the same physician. And this is basically the data showing that in this set, there was more preference for the COX-2 than for the other NSAIDs. And so here you see that we have actually few bleedings, even though it's a very large database, within 60 days. And that's what we will work with. So we have, for this example, both a binary instrument, a binary exposure measure, and a binary outcome in a very simple setting. And a causal parameter of interest for the binary outcome we will be expressing, like we would for association analysis, presumably, in terms of an odds ratio. And in particular, we look at the odds of the risk for people, for the group which had a particular instrumental variable set and a particular exposure level set, and try to contrast that odds, that observed odds in that stratum of the population with what we will infer to be the odds under treatment-free conditions, so under the non-COX-2 regime in that same stratum of the population. And some people have a lot of qualms with this, but this is our measure of causal effect and is, of course, a potential outcome which is not necessarily observed, and these are all observed variables. So it expresses how much the odds of success would change for subjects with observed X and Z if they had not taken the COX-2. So we modeled that causal odds ratio on the logs linear scale, but initially here very simply, just the odds ratio is the exponential of psi, or if you rewrite that model, the logit of these different observed and counterfactual risks is psi star, the xi. So psi will be my key parameter here that I'd like to estimate. And I'll go through several approaches that exist today and try to see whether we can favor some or not, and at least understand their properties. So what we in 2003, Stein and I, proposed to do was, given the causal model, so the observed logit minus the treatment-free logit is psi, it's clear that we can't do, as in the linear structure model, just transform the observed outcome using the causal parameter to the extent that after transformation we have the same baseline risk observed in the two levels of the instrument, because that transformation gets complicated due to the non-collapsibility of the logistic transformation. So we can't go on and transform the Y directly using the parameter that we are interested in, but what we can do instead is basically work on the logit of the risk scale. So if we were able to have at least an estimate of this, then we could subtract from that guy our causal effect to bring it back to the treatment-free logit of the risk, and then demand that these treatment-free logits of the risk are the same at different levels of the instrument. Because if we do subtract the right causal effect, that should be the case, given the fact that the instrument has as a property that it's not correlated with the treatment-free response of people. Yes, on average over X, conditional on Z only, yes. Thank you. All right, so that's what we do here. So we propose to add a model for the observed association. So these are all observed variables now. So in that sense, it's standard logistic regression modeling. We can have main effects and interactions if we like, or be in general, quite flexible at this level. And then the combination of both the causal and the association model allows us to back transform the estimated risk to the estimated treatment-free risk, here still conditional on X and Z. So this is on the logit scale. We back transform it to the original scale. And this transformation of the data involving the parameters, both of the association and the causal model, gives us our estimate of the treatment-free risk, if you like, and hence outcome. And so here it says that, indeed, conditional on Z, there should be, after we average over X and we're only left with the conditioning on Z, this should be independent of Z due to the property of the instrument. All right, and this means that, especially in this simple case, it's a very easy equation to solve along with the association equation, and it ends up having a closed form solution, which is a solution of a quadratic equation for pi psi. So two simple steps, really. Fit the association model, solve that simple equation, which is closed form, and there you are. You have your psi hat estimator of the causal effect in this case, not assuming anything about unmeasured confounders, but relying on the instrument and its properties. Some people initially were worried about this added extra model that you impose here on the observed data. But of course, on the one hand, it's fairly benign since it's standard observed variables modeling. And on the other hand, it turns out that under the causal null, if you do it right, the approach is robust to misspecification of this association model, if you worry about that. So it's a valid, it gives you within that framework a valid test of the causal null, even if the association model is misspecified. So that was nice until Jamie came along, who found that and observed that there might be a problem with this approach in the sense that the association model could be incongenial with the causal model. So it means that there may, given the parametric forms involved, it's possible that there are no values of psi for which this actually is achievable. Or especially if Z is continuous and you have many levels, this may be hard to actually make exactly true. So it can happen under parametric model for the main effect of the IV and the association model, but we realized after thinking some more and learning from his subsequent paper that it's not a problem when the main effect of Z in the association model is left unrestricted. And of course, if Z is binary, that's automatically the case. You're not imposing any restrictions there. With a categorical instrument, which typically they have in Mendelian randomization, having three levels, it's also very easy to achieve that, to just let it be two dummies for the main effect in the association model. And for general IVs, you could resort to a smooth generalized additive association model for the observed variables, and you wouldn't have that problem. So we learned something, but I think in the end we also learned that the problem is actually, in practice, often not a big issue. However, when to overcome that problem, Jamie and Andrea came up with an alternative approach that doesn't suffer from it, from the incongeniality when it occurs. And in order to go there, their auxiliary or added model beyond the causal model was phrased in terms of YI0, the treatment-free response. So what they do, rather than parameterize the observed association, they parameterize the selection bias function, if applied to this case. And so conditional on the value of the instrument, they look at the difference in logit risk, say, between the people who are exposed and who are not. So how different are they, the different exposure levels, in terms of their treatment-free response? That's selection, what we call that's the non-causal part of the association. So if that function which they parameterize here were to be zero for all x, it implies basically that there's no confounding in that sense. So in order to work out their approach with that additional model, what they they go through three steps. They compute an MLE for alpha in the model that regresses exposure on Z on one. Then for they have to estimate the parameters in the selection model that they propose. Of course, you have to do that through observed data. So from these models, they derive a model for the observed association, which now involves the causal part, the selection model part, and a third term, which parameterizes the treatment-free risk among the unexposed for given values of Z, and does that in such a way that basically it allows that after averaging out the X given Z, you indeed obtain something which can be independent of Z. So that third step makes sure that the incongeniality problem does not occur. And then finally, they solve an equation with their own back transformed version of the data, which is very similar to ours, which relies on the instrument to estimate the causal parameter psi, where all the others have been estimated conditional on psi. As in our case, the d's there can be chosen to obtain semi-parametric efficiency, and so they have three steps. Difference being, I think, for one, a that by definition the incongeniality problem does not arise, but it turns out to be quite hard to have this third step happening in the data analysis. And the other thing is that their added model works in terms of unobserved things, because it's for yi0 rather than unobserved. And in that sense, it's also more complicated. They also share the property that under the null, the estimator is locally robust against mass specification of the added models. Well, what we found is, certainly for the binary instrument, that in all cases we tried, we found no difference between the two estimators. They came out exactly the same. And so in that sense, in this case, we thought we had also theoretically shown that they were identical, but we're not entirely sure anymore of that proof right now. But certainly in those cases, it seems that our model, since it models observable data rather than latent ones, and is much, much simpler to implement, because the version shown here is for the simple case and gets much harder and also computationally harder in general. So that, for us, might be a reason why to actually still be happy perhaps with the older method, because it's much simpler. It coincides in lots of cases, and it doesn't actually suffer from the incongeniality problem if you model the main effect of Z properly. So applied on these data from Brookhart and Schneeweiss for the COX-2 inhibitors, what we find, and so the two versions, Jamie's or our model, actually give exactly the same answers. So they predict, in terms of causal ratio, it's a huge one, but also with a big, big wide confidence interval, nevertheless, significant on the one hand. So it does show or estimate a huge reduction in the risk of bleeding for people who use COX-2. And that's in stark contrast with the observed association analysis, where the standard logistic regression gives you a coefficient there, which translates into an odds ratio that goes in the opposite direction and does suggest an increased GI bleeding risk with the COX-2 inhibitor is used. All right, so these are what we call...
I mean, no one would do at least the observational ordinary logistic without trying to adjust for other...
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So. Yeah. No, you know, that's true. You wouldn't do that. So this is, in a simple setup, the exact methods. And then I'm trying to show you some of the methods that they are not used, as far as you can tell, in Mendelian randomization, for instance. Instead, people use approximate methods, which I'm not entirely sure why they don't use the exact ones. But the approximates, as you can imagine, do have bias issues. And I'll try to carry you through them here. So first one starts basically from a probit modeling idea. So rather than the logistic link, the inverse cumulative distribution of the normal is used there in the probit setting. And with a probit link for the causal model, you can actually implement our approach in exactly the same way, parallel as what we've done before, adding also a probit association model. It works through. If you wish, and that's what they do in that field, you could add a third model for the exposure given Z. And if that is normal, the answer simplifies greatly in the sense that these models jointly deliver a regression model for Y not given Z, which looks like this. And so the demand of the instrument that the left-hand side is no longer dependent on the instrument translates into this expression, where basically the causal effect estimator on the probit scale is now a simple function of the association parameters on the one hand and the slope in the X given Z model on the other hand. So that's a start. So that yields indeed a two-stage IV estimator one, which works like this. Just does what I just said. There are two modifications of that which have become popular here. And the first one they obtain by additionally averaging over the exposure in the association model to observe this relationship here, where in the association model, the slope with Z turns out to be a function of phi, or causal parameter of interest, and alpha, the parameter occurring in the regression of X on Z. So what is proposed in this setting then is to do regress Y on Z using a probit model and use that slope along with the other parameters estimated here to come to the phi hat estimate. So that's one. Perhaps worth noting is that if we are under the causal null in this case, then this slope, the observed association slope, will also be zero. And so then this will always work under the null. A third modification of this, which Thomas and Conti proposed, and which has become quite popular.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's not sufficient for showing it, because the question is, will the, because they have these other parameters to estimate.
Yeah.
If those models are misspecified, will this affect, is that a, they're estimating, so it won't, even if they're misspecified, you're going to do fine under the null.
Yeah.
So it doesn't require the model.
Yeah. And so in this next one, they add another layer of approximation. They substitute theta 1 hat, the slope in the association model, with the causal slope, if you like, and use that to obtain then this estimate. And the reason for doing that is that this final approximation does not involve anything that relates to the joint association between Y on the one hand and X and Z on the other hand. It only involves parameters from the regression of Y on Z and of X on Z. And particularly for meta-analysis purposes, which they like to do, they prefer that because that information is often available and the regression of Y on X and Z often is not. But this is only valid when the association between outcome and exposure is in fact unconfounded, as you can tell from this substitution, but also works when the causal null hypothesis holds. And you need the thing under the root there to be positive as well. All right. So these are, of course, in probit notation, and you may, or in probit link land. You may be happy to stay there, or what's often done is people move that up to translate the probit parameter into the logistic parameter and hence into the causal odds ratio. But it's quite well known that this approximation only works fine as long as you have risks between 10% and 90%. If they're much smaller or much larger, that becomes a really bad approximation and doesn't work that well there. So, maybe to say, so the fact that it's okay under the causal null is right for version 2 and 3 of this two-stage estimation method, but it doesn't hold for the version 1 that I showed you. So applied to our data then, this approach, the three versions of this two-stage IV estimation that is popular Mendelian randomization would give you very similar answers, however, presumably unbelievable answers, because in this case, our risk of GI bleeding is very, very small, much smaller even than 1%. So that last step of translating the probit into a logit parameter is not quite right at all. And then another class of approximate methods that's used there basically relies on interchanging expectation and the logit. So that's obviously sometimes pretty crude approximation, so essentially almost linearizing the nonlinear logit transformation. And then if you do that, then to realize that the logit of the risk, observed risk given z, becomes approximately a sum of the logit of the treatment-free risk given z plus the causal effect parameter times the expected value of x given z now. And so because the instrument dictates that this no longer depends on z, it means that you have a constant here and the only z dependence left in this regression then of y on z is from the regression of x on z stemming. And this, once you hear it, it's simple. Of course, the big step was up there. All right. So the approach now works simply. Regress y on the predicted x from z, using a model for that, and then take that slope as a measure of your causal odds ratio. And again, the reason why this is so popular is because this winds up being so that on the one hand, this estimator only involves regression of y on z on the one hand and of the relation between x and z on the other hand, and never the joint relationship again. So just like the one before, that's the big attraction of it. Yes, thank you. So I've barely said that. So it's very popular with Mendelian randomization, features in meta-analysis. It tends to, however, be biased, even in large samples. Requires correct specification of that first stage regression model. And at the null hypothesis of no causal effect, it is so that it will converge, though, to zero in probability. So that's the good news. There's been an extra modification made of it where they additionally regress on the residual x minus xi prime in the hopes of reducing the bias when psi is not zero. And here you see the application of that last approach to this data set. So these two are also sitting quite close together, but still are quite a distance from the exact methods in the other direction of the other ones. Obviously, most of them have large wide confidence intervals, but that's because there's really few events here. Risk is low. Yes, you can do that, but then you don't have a single parameter anymore. You get one at every level.
Yeah, that's not a bug, that's a feature, right?
Yeah, sure.
You don't have that.
Yeah, you can stay there. You can absolutely stay there and be happy.
You've got to be frank about it. If you do it that way, you have to confront the issue.
Well, I thought I said it, but thank you for repeating it.
Yeah. So why not put it on that scale then? Because then I can compare these.
Well, you can do that. You have to put two different numbers there then, one for every level of z. Yeah, you could do that. All right, so we ran some simulations, and basically we tried to go through the route that Jamie proposed to make sure everything fits together. So the outcome generated on the logistic structural mean model, having the different parts in there, with the eta here being the parameterization for the selection model, and that's the causal one, and then another one to make sure there's no incongeniality in the data generating mechanism. Chose different risk levels to also see what the impact is of just having, you know, very few events, so how things get better. So psi 0 versus 2, so no causal effect, there is one, and different degrees of confounding, including no confounding. And then basically different strengths of the instrument, if you like, Z relationship with X. And so for the weakest information, we additionally considered also a larger sample size. So the others were size 1,000. For the weakest, we also looked at 10,000. For the exact solution, there were some situations where we actually didn't have one because the quadratic equation had a discriminant which was negative. So for now, in the simulations, we just left that open. We didn't include it. We didn't try to impute something else there. When there were two solutions, which was very, very rare, we took the one closer to the two-stage IV estimator, and that was it. And the other one also doesn't give a solution when that part of the equation under the root was negative. So basically, first qualitatively, we found under the alternative, as expected, that only the exact estimator guaranteed to be unbiased. And particularly as the sample size grows, that shows true. All the others are usually biased, even when there's no confounding. But they may be less affected by outlying estimates, so less variability. Disregarding a few outliers, so using the robust measures of variation, the variability was basically similar for all these methods. Then under the null, the approximate estimator can have substantial bias, which grows with confounding. That actual extra adjustment there for the residual from the regression of X and Z didn't help. We didn't see any real benefit in what we simulated. And the two-stage IV estimator was actually closest to the adjusted one, very, very highly correlated. And generally doing better, in fact, than these two that are under the causal null robust. We also looked at the situation where the X was normal, which is basically what one set of these methods was designed for, and then, not surprisingly, that set of methods did better, much better. So I could let you look at this, but maybe I'll jump to the conclusions and then leave that slide back up. So in terms of conclusions, we have to remember that, at any rate, the way the causal ratio measure is defined here is conditional on Z, and because of the non-collapsibility, that would not coincide with one that averages over Z. There are obviously assumptions involved. The key is always the instrument, and that we took here from previous work. That's the most important one. The second is the causal model, which is kept quite simple here. And then thirdly, these other models, but they are much less crucial in their role. So what we in the example ignored was further physician-related effects, if there's any correlation between patients of the same physician. We did find that these approximate methods, which are actually the only ones used in the Mendelian randomization crowd, can go quite wrong, and it's a bit unclear why they don't use the exact methods. In the comparison between our method and Jamie's, we probably right now like to stick with ours, partly also because Jamie's is very, very hard to implement. Our student sort of broke his fingers on it in a more complex situation. It's very, very difficult. And at any rate, you need enough information to apply these methods usefully. So thank you.
something like that we need for local average treatment effects. You're not making a monotonicity assumption, or you are?
No, so like in the original exact case, we're having a disassociation model and a causal model.
Now, what I have in mind that you know, this in your empirical example, and more generally in the case of a binary instrument, I guess a very simple way to do this, if you have something like monotonicity, which in your empirical example is reasonable. It's like, well, then you are in a local average treatment effect situation, and then you know that you can identify anything for compliers. You could run, logistic regression for compliers. But of course, that's going to work in the case of a binary issue.
Yes, yeah. So this can handle both for X and Z completely general.
For what you're doing in the empirical example.
For the example. We could
just. And, you could include covariates there. Now, given that your motivation is like we are not going to do something simple, this is something that is something extremely simple.
Yes, but then you're working with your latent classes of complier under different regimes.
To estimate this thing for compliers.
Yeah.
That's
then you're starting to estimate, adding a different layer of latent variables to identify your causal effect in latent subpopulations, which you never observe, and if you're willing to do that.
Well, you never observe, but you can identify anything for them, so you can see if they are old or young, or they are women or men, or they, you cannot identify individuals in this population, but you can describe this population as, as much as you want. I mean, it's just a trade-off between the assumptions that you're making in one case and the other.
Yeah.
I was thinking that in particular, in the empirical example, monotonicity seems to be a quite natural assumption there.
I think in the original papers, they did assert monotonicity, that the drug could
reduce
your bleeding risk, and that the physician's preference would never reduce your probability of getting the drug. If the physician
That's right, positive. Yeah.
So they did assert
They did do some of that.
Yeah, but we show, Miguel and I show in our paper that the instrument they used, what they actually used, the measured instrument they used, is how the physician treated the last patient.
Mm-hmm.
And we show that it's logically, so the underlying, so you have to view that. That's just our local brand. So what we show is that only makes sense as an instrument. That will only satisfy the exclusion restriction if the true instrument is continuous. That is, if you imagine each physician has a percent.
Like a propensity?
A propensity.
Yeah, for prescribing.
Assigning one of the, assigning, giving one drug or the other. And if you then dichotomize that into whether it's greater or less than 50%, and pretend that's the instrument, and then that's what we call the causal instrument in the graph. That is, and then you view the instrument you use. It's complicated.
You get it wrong because
you get it wrong because there's information in how you treated the last patient unless you use the continuous instrument. So. What your methods would still work, but they wouldn't be estimating late. They'd be estimating, the integrated continuous version of late with this weird weighting function, the one they get in fish or whatever that is. Or, but, there's this, Angerson Imbens gets this formula, and what do we do about fish? And Hetman gets it somewhere else, and I don't know, got it first. That the instrumental variables then. Doing a weighted average of the, instantaneous level at the value of the percent of the kind of physician you are. Your methods would still work.
No,
but estimating that weird thing.
But that's the case of a miscoded instrument or something like that.
That's right, and theirs will be a miscoded. So they don't have waiting for any plausible binary answer. They would, because you want to, if you try to binary, you want to, the true instrument isn't, wouldn't be binary in this case. It, this was outside your assumption, but.
Yeah, thanks.
Just so I understand the instrument better, so it's the last patient, if I gave a COX-2 inhibitor in his prescription?
Yeah.
The non-steroids are not prescriptions. So if I give someone ibuprofen, is that not, that's not in the database then?
It was with, yeah, with non-COX-2 NSA.
Yeah, but I versus a prescription by ibuprofen is over the counter.
So yeah, this was prescribed. This was all prescribed, the way I understand it.
So that's kind of weird, right? So if I tell a person to go take aspirin, I'm not going to write a script for that. So that, that's not, that patient's not in the database. My previous patient, I could have given aspirin to you, and that's not in the database.
So probably you don't know, nor I know.
Yeah.
What they actually did about that point.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. I don't know what they did to get around it.
So it seems like a big point. Most non-steroid.
Maybe they reviewed. Maybe they reviewed charts.
But except if the question, if the question is, but if the question, I think the question of relevance is, if you wanted to prescribe an NSAID, which one is the best one to then prescribe?
Observe that unless you get the medical records. But, you know, Kaiser is supposed to have great medical records. And if, when I know the Kaiser system, it's not going to be able to pick up whether I told the patient.
Yeah, we have to check the Brookhart article.
So if the late thing is about the type, I'm losing that information about the type if I have, like, 8% of my patients, I go take aspirin.
I don't think that was the issue. I mean, I don't think that was a problem.
I mean, these guys are in the hospital. They have a lot of theoretical stuff I can't believe.
Right.
I mean, they're doctors, and they know what they're doing about it. I don't know what they did, but I can't believe they blew something up.
They are using people who are taking these drugs, but they have to take these drugs not once, but on a continuous basis, and they have pharmacy coverage. So they have some studies that show that people who have pharmacy coverage and have to take these drugs, not once, but for life or for a long time, they get those drugs through their doctors. So they appear on their ICMEGA records. This is not the big issue here. There are many big issues with this instrument.
Yeah.
I mean, based on the monotonicity part, there are all the things that Jamie said. If you don't use the monotonicity part, then there are a lot of issues with this instrument. Really meets the assumptions.
This model gets identification by assuming there's no interaction with Z. Is that the model?
Yeah.
Notice that the contrast doesn't depend on Z, right? The model. Because if you have two parameters, you're identification. But you decided, but that means if you went for the log, it would depend on Z. And if you went for additive, it would depend on Z. So if you decided to fit, so this contradicts an additive instrumental variable model with no interaction with Z, and it contradicts a multiplicative interaction model, and you'll get completely different estimates. The limit will be different. This is just showing how bad the real identification problem is. That is, if you finally convert everything to the average treatment effect, you will get different infinite sample average treatment effects, depending whether you use that model. Put a log there, but leave both out. So, and why, on what scale, and why should it not interact with Z? And if you think through causal DAGs and stuff, you would think it would interact with Z on every scale. So, it's a wish and a prayer, to say the least, with no logical basis to choose.
And they are finding an effect that is an order of magnitude.
I mean, except under the null. Of course, under the null, those are all the same. Then it won't depend on Z, and they're fine. Away from the null, they're saying completely different things just by the model.
Yeah, if you bring in other covariates, though, and you assume no interaction further with those, then you can add an interaction term in the causal model, if you like.
So it's kind of, so there's a rich possibility for debate, like the no interacts on the additive scale group will get one estimate, and then no interacts on the multiplicative scale group will get a different estimate, and then there's no empirical basis for this going one versus the other, so lots of discussion in this.
Yeah. Well, yeah.